Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. A reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 6, Chapter 1, The History of the Life of Ajamil, Text 31.
Vikashaton taridayad Dasi patim ajamilam Yama prishan vishnu duta Varayama so ojasa Vikashaton taridayad Dasi patim ajamilam Yama prishan vishnu duta Varayama so ojasa Vikashaton taridayad Dasi patim ajamilam Yama prishan vishnu duta Varayama so ojasa Vikashaton taridayad Dasi patim ajamilam Yama prishan vishnu duta Varayama so ojasa Vikashaton taridayad Dasi patim ajamilam Yama prishan vishnu duta Varayama shojasa.
Ladies. Vikashata snatching. Antarirayat, from within the heart. Dasipatim, the husband of the prostitute. Ajamilam, Ajamil. Yama Preshan, the messengers of Yamaraj. Vishnu Duta, the order carriers of Lord Vishnu. Varayamasu, forbade. Ojasa, with resounding voices. Translation: the order carriers of Yamaraj were snatching the soul from the core of the heart of Ajamil, the husband of the prostitute. But with resounding voices, the messengers of Lord Vishnu, the Vishnu Dutas, forbade them to do so. Please repeat. The order carriers of Yamaraj were snatching the soul from the core of the heart of Ajamil, the husband of the prostitute. But with resounding voices, the messengers of Lord Vishnu, the Vishnu Dutas, forbade them to do so. Purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. A Vaishnav, one who has surrendered to the lotus feet of Lord Vishnu, is always protected by Lord Vishnu's order carriers. Because Ajamil chanted the holy name of Narayan, the Vishnu Dutas not only immediately arrived on the spot, but also at once ordered the Yamadutas not to touch him. By speaking with resounding voices, the Vishnu Dutas threatened to punish the Yamadutas if they continue trying to snatch Ajamil's soul from his heart. The order carriers of Yamaraj have jurisdiction over all sinful living entities, but the messengers of the Lord, the Vishnu Dutas, are capable of punishing anyone, including Yamaraj, if he wrongs a Vaishnav. Materialistic scientists do not know where to find the soul within the body with their material instruments. But this verse clearly explains that the soul is within the core of the heart, Hridaya. It is from the heart that the Yamadutas were extracting the soul of Ajamil. Similarly, we learn that the Supersoul, Lord Vishnu, is also situated within the heart, Ishvarar Sarvabhutanam Riddeshe Dunatishtati. In the Upanishads, it is said that the Supersoul and the individual soul are living in the same tree of the body as two friendly birds. The Supersoul is said to be friendly because the Supreme Personality of Godhead is so kind to the original soul that when the original soul transmigrates from one body to another, the Lord goes with him. Furthermore, according to the desire and karma of the individual soul, the Lord, through the agency of Maya, creates another body for him. The heart of the body is a mechanical arrangement, as the Lord says in Bhagavad Gita 18:61, Ishvara sarvabhutanam riddeshe junatishtati brahmayan sarvabhutani yantrarudani mayaya. The Supreme Lord is situated in everyone's heart, O Arjuna, and is directing the wanderings of all living entities who are seated as on a machine made of the material energy. Yantra means a machine, such as an automobile. The driver of the machine of the body is the individual soul, who is also its director or proprietor. But the supreme proprietor is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. One's body is created through the agency of Maya, Karmana Deva Netrena. And according to one's activities in this life, another vehicle is created, again under the supervision of Daivi Maya. At the appropriate time, one's next body is immediately chosen, and both the individual soul and the supersoul transfer to that particular bodily machine. This is the progress of transmigration. During transmigration from one body to the next, The soul is taken away by the order carriers of Yamaraj and put into a particular type of hellish life, Naraka, in order to become accustomed to the condition in which he will live in his next body. Translation again. The order carriers of Yamaraj were snatching the soul from the core of the heart of Ajamil, the husband of the prostitute. But with resounding voices, the messengers of Lord Vishnu, the Vishnu Dutas, forbade them to do so. Om Majana Tamranda Shah Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Unmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swaya Rupa Gadamayam Dadati Swabhadantikam Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shri Vasadi Gaura Bhaktavrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare Hare Hari Rama, Hari Rama, Rama Rama, Hari Hari. If we needed reminding, Srila Prabhupada created an international society. I'm looking in the assembly of Vaishnavas today and I'm seeing Prahladananda Maharaj, and I'm seeing Radhakrishna Prabhu, I'm seeing Doyal Govinda Prabhu, I'm seeing Madan Gopal Prabhu. And probably one or two others who are not at class. But less than a week ago, we were all in Radhadesh. And when we were in Radhadesh, we obviously had Bhagavatam class each morning. And this was the chapter that we were reading from in Bhagavatam class in Radhadesh. And now we all moved over to Mumbai. And here we are, reading the same chapter of Bhagavatam. So, yes, Srila Prabhupada, definitely, just in case we had forgotten, created an international society. Okay. Wonderful translation, wonderful purport. And where to start? I thought I'd read just again. The driver of the machine of the body is the individual soul, who is also its director or proprietor, but the supreme proprietor is the supreme personality of Godhead. And in essence, there are so many things you can say in essence about the Krishna conscious philosophy. But in essence, you can say this is the essence of our philosophy. Yes, we're the proprietor of this body, but actually there's another proprietor, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And when we understand that, realize that, and act on that platform, then we start to make real progress in spiritual life. But as long as we're identifying with the material body as ourselves, and not just as the material body being ourself, but that we own it, we're in control of it, it's ours, we'll do with it as we want to do, then we're in trouble. But Krishna, being so merciful, and obviously I think for most personalities, certainly for myself, I'll speak for myself, it's very nice to focus on Krishna being all merciful. He's the all merciful Supreme Personality of Godhead. Actually, this part of the Bhagavatam, it's described how, you know, the parts preceding it, dealing with creation and the different planetary systems and all of that kind of stuff. Just before this chapter, Sukadeva Goswami is describing the hellish planets, etc. But this section starts the posana section, or the section described as protection. And that's a nice feeling, you know, it's a secure, nice feeling that someone has your best interests at heart. And Krishna does. He has all of our best interests at heart. So earlier on in the purport, it says, the super soul is said to be friendly because the Supreme Personality of Godhead is so kind to the original soul that when the original soul transmigrates from one body to another, the Lord goes with him. So no matter where we go, Krishna goes with us. No matter how much we reject him, no matter how much we spit in his face, he stays with us all the time and just waiting until we turn to him and acknowledge his presence and acknowledge who he is. And he's there all the time. There's one saying in English, God only exists in the minds of those who cannot deal with their mortality. It's basically a mantra of the atheists. God only exists in the minds of those who cannot deal with their mortality. Actually, God only does not exist in the minds of those who rely solely on their sense perception to determine what is reality. That's actually what the situation is. But they're so proud and so arrogant and so confident and so brash that they make that statement to anybody who is trying to practice a religious stroke spiritual life. God, he only exists because you guys cannot deal with your mortality. So you're creating him to give yourself a crutch to live your life with. And of course, to some degree it's true, because it's not good enough just to have a statement like that. You have to live your life according to those tenets and according to those principles. But when I was reading the verse this morning, I was thinking, it doesn't often happen, but this verse actually relates to one of the pictures, one of the wonderful, wonderful pictures in the Bhagavatam here, if I can find it quickly and show it to you all. And of course I can't find it. Why can't I find it? It was in the... Oh, there it is it? Yeah, there it is. Of course you won't really see this, but I'm sure you're familiar with this. This is the picture of... don't want to lose my... Oh, there, I've got the thing. This is the picture of the Yamadutas coming and trying to snatch the soul of Ajamil, and you have the Vishnu Dutas contesting that, etc. Now, how fortunate those atheists are. God, he only exists in the minds of those who cannot deal with their mortality. So here's the situation for those atheists when they have to deal with their mortality. You know, you kind of get a sense that they might have a quick change of heart at the point of death, at the moment of death, when those Vishnu Dutas, and unfortunately for most of those atheists, of course spiritual life is such that we never know what's actually going to happen, but for most of those atheists, the Vishnu Dutas won't be coming to contest where they're going. So those Yamadutas will just be coming to yank them out of their bodily existence. And what a horrendous, frightful experience that must be. And hence, all of us sitting here today, engaging as best we can in spiritual life, for many reasons, but for one of those reasons, again speaking for myself, for one of those reasons, to hopefully avoid that reality visiting me again, because no doubt it has visited me many, many, many times in previous existences. Okay, so leading up to the verse that we've read today, Sukadeva Goswami, when Maharaj Parikit, who in his infinite compassion, following in the footsteps of the Supersoul of Paramatma, Maharaj Parikit, he asks Sukadeva Goswami, not how can he be saved from those hellish planets, because Sukadeva has just described all the hellish planets, and I'm sure you've all read the descriptions of the hellish planets that we're told are not allegorical, that they're actually real. Wow. So Maharaj Parikit, in his infinite compassion, asks Sukadeva Goswami, how can we save all of humanity from that destination? He doesn't ask, how can I save myself? Which, of course, I'm thinking again, speaking for myself, if I had somebody there who could give me the answers, that's exactly what I would ask, you know, hey, you know, how can I save myself from this predicament? But he's asking, how can all of humanity be saved? And they go through the different... Sukadeva Goswami initially explains that it's by atonement. It says he's testing Maharaj Parikit, and he says it's by atonement. And then it develops, the conversation develops, and we understand that atonement can compensate for the specific sinful activities that you've engaged in. And it talks about the Dharma Shastras and all the different things that you can do. But ultimately, performing austerity and penance and even the acquirement and attainment of knowledge, that those things alone are not good enough to remove the desire in the heart to commit sinful activity. So therefore, the conclusion is that they're basically a waste of time, because they can neutralize the sinful activity that you've committed, but they cannot get rid of the desire to commit further sinful activity. So therefore, in the context of eternality, they're actually useless. Because if you're going to commit sinful activity again, it really doesn't matter, just that you've neutralized the sinful activity that you may have committed at that particular time. So the solution then that's given is devotional service, bhakti yoga. And going back to the translation of the purport that I remember from Radhadesh a few short days ago, Prabhupada quotes in the purport the Mam Cha Yo Vya Bicharena verse. And of course the English translation of that verse is, devotional service is so strong. So that's what Sukadeva Goswami is confirming, that that's what can get rid of the actual sinful activities in the heart. Devotional service is so strong that if one, and I'll slip it in, fully surrenders to Krishna and takes fully to his devotional service, the reactions of his sinful life immediately stop. So in that translation, the word fully is mentioned twice. Engages in full devotional service. So I'm going to now reveal my mind. But it won't be as bad for those who are in Radhadesh. It won't be as bad as the revelations that a certain devotee, when he did a drama, revealed his mind in Radhadesh. That was pretty horrific. But I was tempted the other evening on the invitation of another glorious Vaishnav to go and have some ice cream in a local ice cream parlor here that's supposedly very famous for natural ice cream. You probably all know it, all you resident Mumbai devotees, right? You all know the place I'm talking about, huh? Anyways, when we do those kind of things, we're not engaged in full devotional service. And maybe many times throughout the day, thoughts that come into our mind, things that we do or read or whatever it might be, don't necessarily fall into the category of full devotional service. But what's being said here is that in order to free ourselves and uproot that desire for sinful activity, we have to engage in full devotional service. And that's quite a theme throughout the Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavad Gita 10.7, the verse that precedes the Chatur Shloki of the Bhagavad Gita, is Etam Vibhutam Yogam Cham Amayo Veti Tatvataha Zovikalpena Yogena Yujate Natra Samshaya. And there Krishna is saying to Arjuna, and I know that Prahlad Nanda Maharaj will help me with the English if I flip up, but there Krishna is saying to Arjuna, one who engages in full unalloyed devotional service and is fully conscious of who I am, all my glories and all my mystic power and my mystic opulences, so one who understands that, who I actually am, Krishna, engages in full devotional service. Of this there is no doubt. So the corollary of that verse is that if we're not engaged in full devotional service, then we don't actually understand who Krishna is fully, and we don't accept who Krishna is fully. We have some doubt, because Krishna says, of this there is no doubt. So there must be some doubt there. And then in the 15th chapter, I think 15:19, Yoma Mevam Asam Mudho, Krishna makes the exact same point, that one who understands and knows, he engages in full devotional service. So it's a constant theme. Or one who knows me without doubting, he says in that verse, engages in full devotional service. Excuse me. So it's a constant theme throughout the Bhagavad Gita, what's required to engage in full devotional service, and then of course what the result of engaging in full devotional service is. So it's only full devotional service, it's only bhakti yoga, that can actually free us from what Ajamil was freed from. And what was he actually freed from? I read a nice description one time of the heavenly planets. It was a commentary on the heavenly planets, and it was describing that when you are dying and when you're leaving your body, at that particular point in time when that's taking place, it's not necessarily that your next destination has been decided. It's still being calculated, because you know you've been committing sinful activities, or at least sinful thoughts, essentially right up to the point that you're leaving your body. So, you know, Yamaraj or whoever the other personalities are that are engaged in deciding your next destination. But let's take Yamaraj as an example in this particular example. They're still calculating where you're going. And it's described, it's like one of these, you know when your plane lands on the runway and you're waiting for that air bridge to come? And you know, if you're an impatient personality like myself, I'm always actually waiting for that air bridge to come, and it always takes longer than it should, and you've already been on the plane for, you know, God knows how many hours, and you're just waiting to get off. So you're waiting for this air bridge to come. So it's like that. You've left your body and your soul is now waiting for the air bridge, the particular air bridge that's going to take you to your particular destination. So you can go to a glorious destination. You can go to Goloka Vrindavan. You can go to a less glorious destination like the heavenly planets. Or you can go to the worst destination of all, New York City or some such place. No, you can go to the hellish planet. So it's waiting like that. The air bridge is waiting. And while it's waiting, while you're waiting for that air bridge, you've already been arrested. You're already in the company of the Yamadutas. And you'll see them in that picture. You can have a look later. And the Yamadutas, generally speaking, they're accompanied by these wonderful Maharaj is saying fox terriers or puppies. Unfortunately, they're not fox terriers or puppies. They're slightly more horrific dogs. They're these, you know, these dogs. I don't know if you have these dogs in India. They've become a real kind of nuisance in the West, at least where I come from. You get all these, you know, heavy-duty characters who always get themselves these dogs. You know, these guys who have skinheads, you know, like us, but they have tattoos, like some of us. But anyway, those heavy-duty skinhead-type characters. And they have these dogs, and these dogs are always drooling at the mouth, and their teeth are always showing, and they're always straining at the leash, and they look like they just always want to eat you. And I don't know for you, but if I'm walking down the street and I see someone with one of those dogs coming towards me, I always make it my business to say, oh yes, I have to cross the road now and go over that side and do something. So they're very, very frightening dogs. And the Yamadutas are accompanied by these dogs, and it's described that these dogs are actually biting you. As you're waiting for that air bridge or that air tunnel to come, these dogs are, they're already biting you, you know, your ankles and your calves and your legs and your arms and like that, you know. And the pain is so intense and the pain is so horrible and hellish that what you want to do is you want to die. You want to leave your body. But the problem is you've already left your body. You're already dead. And you can't die. You don't have that option. And you just have to suffer the pain and the misery that's accompanied or that comes with the biting, etc., of these dogs. Of course, in Ajamil's case, we know that what happened was his 10th son, he called Narayan, and at the time of death, he was really attached to his son. And, you know, as I said before, I have two sons myself. And again, speaking personally, you know, I can't imagine chanting my son's name at the time of death. I just can't imagine it. I'm just not that attached to my son. Maybe if I had a daughter, I might chant my daughter's name, but I'd probably still chant my wife's name. I'm probably sufficiently attached to my wife to chant her name. And fortunately, her name is Goloka, so that's a pretty good one. But my son's name, I don't know if any of you have sons, but somehow or other I can't relate to chanting my son's name at the time of death. But anyway, Ajamil was. He was super attached to his son, and he chanted Narayan. And just on the chanting of that, we heard yesterday it's Naam Vaas. It wasn't pure chanting. But just on the chanting of Narayan's name, he remembered Narayan. It's described that he actually remembered Narayan. And of course, not just that he remembered Narayan, but the Vishnu Dutas, that's their calling card. Somebody's chanting Krishna's name at the time of death, that's the Vishnu Dutas calling card. So the Vishnu Dutas came. So for us, it's also interesting that, you know, we've all chanted Hare Krishna. All of us this morning were chanting Hare Krishna. We were all chanting following Jagjivan Prabhu's ninth kirtan at Guru Puja. So we were chanting Krishna's name. We were chanting Japa before that. Before that, we were chanting Krishna's name at Mangal Arati. So we've chanted Krishna's name. So there can be maybe a complacency that comes in thinking that, well, we're okay, because it is stated actually in Bhagavatam that one who has chanted Krishna's name, the Yamadutas will not come for him. And one time in London, during Srila Prabhupada's time, in Berry Place, some devotees left what we used to call bloot. We don't use that word anymore, but anyway, some devotees had left. And some of the devotees out on Sankirtan met one or two of these devotees. And when they met these devotees, the devotees were encouraging them to come back to the shelter of Prabhupada and the shelter of the holy name, etc. And one of the arguments that these devotees made, they said, oh, that's okay. It says in the Bhagavatam, and I heard Prabhupada say it in a class, that one who's chanted Hare Krishna, they're protected from hellish life and they're protected from the Yamadutas, etc. So we'll be okay because we've already done that. And when Prabhupada heard that, he wrote a letter. And the letter was sent to, maybe sent to other people, but it was sent to Berry Place. And the devotees put the letter up on the notice board in Berry Place. And what Prabhupada said was, yes, Neha Vikram Nashor Steve, that, you know, your devotional service and everything that you've done in devotional service, it will always stay with you. You will never lose that. That will always be to your eternal credit. But, Prabhupada said, whatever nonsense you commit subsequent to that, you will have to suffer for that. Now, we do know, actually, the Karma Netrena, Karmana Deva Netrena verse is quoted in the purport today. We do know from that section of the Bhagavatam that one who has chanted the holy name and who is engaged in devotional service, the Yamadutas don't actually come from them. And it's described how different personalities will come. Anyone from Lord Brahma down, basically, can come to accompany you to the next existence that you have. So in that sense, what those devotees were saying was true. But of course, once you enter again into the material world, and once you take a material body, there's no guarantee that in that particular body that you're necessarily going to take to devotional service, or that you necessarily won't engage in additional sinful life, jai, shishi rada rasa bihari ki jai, or that you won't necessarily engage in additional sinful life that will lead you again to the worst and darkest regions of the material world. So it's a really dodgy and unsure and questionable position to take, to think that I've engaged in some devotional service, therefore I'm protected. So that's on the negative, it's a dangerous position to take. But on the positive, why not, if devotional service is so glorious and so wonderful, why not take as much advantage as possible of the opportunity that we've been given and just engage in devotional service again and again and again? In other words, Srila Prabhupada's letter and the message that Srila Prabhupada was giving was that we shouldn't take a risk. We shouldn't gamble and we shouldn't take a risk. And we have a wonderful opportunity. All of us here have been engaged in devotional service for many of us for a long time like that. And if you take the risk and it doesn't work out, it's described in this section that all pain and misery is coming from sinful activity. Sinful activity is deeply rooted in the innermost depths of our heart. Actually, the picture of the Yamadutas coming and trying to yank Ajamil, his soul, out from the heart. We can use that we also want to do the same with the anartas that are deeply rooted in our heart and those sinful desires that are rooted in our heart. As Devahuti said to Lord Kapila, Nivina Nitaram Bhumam, the association with, connection to, involvement with, any connection to these material senses, it just brings misery and suffering. That's all that it brings. There's one purport, Srila Prabhupada says, there is no satisfaction in this material world. It's a six-word statement, but it's such a powerful, strong statement. There is no satisfaction in this material world. And also in the Bhagavad Gita, it's described how any satisfaction that we perceive is the perception or the striving, thinking that we can be satisfied. But actually there is no satisfaction to be had in this material world. And at the time of death, if we haven't uprooted those material desires, and if we haven't practiced throughout our life, or we haven't practiced detachment from the material body and from the material senses, so we know we have the five working senses, five sense objects, etc., five knowledge acquiring senses. So we have those senses. And if we don't endeavor to become detached from them, then our only real experience in life is experience through those senses. We have no other experience. It's all through the material senses. That is essentially our whole life. So at the time of death, if we haven't practiced any level of detachment to become detached from those senses, then when we're being yanked out by whoever's yanking us out of this body, we're being yanked out of the only thing that we've ever identified with or ever known. And can you imagine the incredible pain of that first, being taken away from that? And then the incredible fear, because that's all we've known, and now we're entering into the complete unknown. So this particular pastime, on one level, it shows Krishna's incredible mercy. And of course we know, we've heard many, many times that we shouldn't demand, we've heard it many times and now I've forgotten it, but we shouldn't demand to see Krishna, we should act in a way that Krishna will recognize us. So Krishna's all merciful, but we shouldn't take advantage of that. We should still endeavor as best as we can to earn his favor and to earn his mercy like that, and not take the risk, as Srila Prabhupada explained. And that, of course, goes for any level of material life. It's described again in this section of Bhagavatam that if you get a demigod body, it's considered jubilant. If you get a human body, it's considered lamentable. And if you get an animal body, it's just full of fear. And of course we know that. I don't know if you've ever seen any of those nature programs where they're studying different animals or different insects. All they ever do in those programs, actually, all they ever do is they show how the animal eats, how it sleeps, how it mates, and how it defends. It never shows how it goes to the opera, you know, or how it goes to a football match, you know, or how they have a chat about philosophy or whatever it is. It's just eating, sleeping, mating, defending every time. But the defending aspect is quite incredible. You see these animals, except for the ones who have no predators. The ones who have no predators are slightly different, actually. But the vast majority of living entities and animals, etc., in the material world, they have predators. And they just live in so much anxiety. Some of these birds and some of these other animals, you see, they're always twitching, you know. And it's just they're constantly fearful that something is coming to get them from behind or in front or whatever the case may be. So whether it's a demigod body, which initially is considered jubilant, or a human body which is lamentable anyway, or an animal body full of fear, that all material existences, they're considered to be nothing but misery and suffering. So the devotee, as the example of Maharaj Parikit, is not just that they want to save themselves, but they also want to save others. And as Maharaj Yudhisthira said, Ahanyahani Bhutani, when he was asked that question, what is the most amazing thing in this material world? And the most amazing thing is that at any given moment, limitless living entities are leaving their bodies. At any moment, limitless living entities are leaving their bodies. But we all have this tendency to live our lives in such a way as if it's not going to happen to us. So one of the best ways that we can avoid that and retain our understanding, because we're constantly, the material energy is constantly pulling us into illusion, you know, and it's a constant battle to try and keep your mind focused on what the actual reality is. So one of the best ways to do that is to engage in what we call preaching. Which some people object to that word preaching these days. So all those who object to that word preaching, I'll say outreach or some such other word. But to keep ourselves focused on that, because it really helps ourselves too. It's not just helping others. And there's a nice story, actually, pastime of Prabhupada, that relates right here to this temple here in Juhu. And Prabhupada was in his quarters one day, and he was with about 15 disciples. And one of these big issues in ISKCON was taking place. I'm not sure which one it is, but it was one of those big ones, like the you know, the Gopi Bhav Club in LA that they were developing, you know, or the Prabhupada's God philosophy they were developing in New Vrindavan. And Prabhupada said, actually, the further west you go, the further west you go, the more Maya there is. So you'll notice that most of these strange deviations that took place in our movement started in America, you know? So anyway, here in Juhu, there was some big crisis taking place. As I say, I can't remember which one it was. And Prabhupada was with about 15 of his disciples, and he was in a very, very grave mood. Very grave mood. And he wasn't speaking at the time, and his disciples were just sitting there, and he was meditating on how to solve this problem, how to deal with this issue. And a gentleman walked in to to Prabhupada's quarters, and he walked in, and he immediately paid his obeisances to Srila Prabhupada and touched Srila Prabhupada's feet. And then he got up, and he looked at Srila Prabhupada and he said, "Swamiji, please give me your blessings." And Prabhupada looked him dead straight in the eye. For quite a long hold, the devotee said, it felt like it was like an hour. It was probably only 30 seconds, but it kind of felt like it was an hour. And they were kind of nervous for the gentleman because they knew Prabhupada was in a very kind of grave mood, you know, and he'd come in and ask this question. And Prabhupada was just staring this man like this, you know. And then Prabhupada eventually spoke and said, "Blessings? Blessings? You want blessings?" He said, "I have started this worldwide movement. We have branches now in Australia, in Africa, in Europe, in America. We have branches all over the world. And to open those branches and to maintain those branches, it is such an endeavor. There's so much stress involved, there's so much anxiety involved, there's so much difficulty involved, and you come asking me for blessings. If you want blessings, you help me with this mission. Then you will get all the blessings that you want." So, again, for us, just such a nice instruction that to get those blessings of Prabhupada, of the previous acharyas, to get the blessings of hopefully remembering at the time of death, remembering who we actually are, who Krishna is, and that we'll have the fortitude and the wherewithal to be able to call on Krishna's holy name, so that that will be the calling card for the Vishnu Dutas, and then the Vishnu Dutas will come, and then we will be accompanied back to Krishna's lotus feet to engage in this movement that Srila Prabhupada has given us. One final little thing I'll say, again a little pastime here, I think also in Mumbai, but this time it was in Juhu. On Juhu Beach, as opposed to Prabhupada's quarters, where it's all Juhu, I guess. This Dr. Patel, who Prabhupada kind of quite liked, but he used to always engage Prabhupada in interesting morning walk conversations like that. So one morning, they were engaging in conversation, and Prabhupada criticized some prominent Indian kind of religious leader. I'm not sure who it was, but he criticized some prominent kind of Indian religious leader. And this Dr. Patel really objected to this. And he started to really get on Prabhupada's case. And of course, Prabhupada wasn't having any of it. And Prabhupada says, it's not me that's criticizing, it's Krishna that's criticizing. He's a mudha. And as Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita. So Prabhupada's giving as good as he got. And Dr. Patel is really getting worked up, you know, and he's obviously really attached to this guy. And he's like really shouting back. And Dr. Patel's followers are getting concerned, and Prabhupada's disciples are getting concerned. And Dr. Patel's followers are actually physically pulling him away and saying, you know, Swamiji has a heart condition, please stop this, like this. So they're trying to calm the whole thing down. And afterwards, some of Prabhupada's disciples, they asked Prabhupada about it, and about Dr. Patel and what his position was. And Prabhupada explained that in English we have the saying, as many faces as the town clock, because the town clock generally has four sides, so as many faces as the town clock. And he was saying that Dr. Patel, he can speak like a Vaishnav, he can speak like a Mayavadi, he can speak like a politician, he can speak like a mundane moralist, he can speak like all of those things, so it's hard to know what he is. But when you actually touch his buttons, then you find out exactly who he is. So in this particular case, and Prabhupada gives the example that some people, they can speak many, many different languages. Actually, we have devotees in our movement who can speak many, many different languages. And because we're an international society, devotees travel so much, they can pick up the dialects and the accents of those languages that they've learned. And sometimes it's hard to know which country they actually come from or what their actual mother tongue is. But Prabhupada gives the example, but if you come up behind somebody and they're not expecting you, they don't know that you're behind them, and you sneak up on them and you go, boom, like that, and they jump, and they go, ah, and they'll start, you know, expressing exactly the language that they speak in. That's their mother tongue, and that's their real tongue, like that. So he was explaining like Dr. Patel. So when I was thinking of that pastime, again speaking for myself, sometimes you're traveling somewhere, you're driving somewhere, or someone's driving you somewhere, and you come. I'm almost embarrassed to admit this, but what can I do? I can't get out of it now. I've started it, so I have to finish. But you know, you're driving somewhere, or someone's driving you, and you know you nearly have a crash, or it looks like you're nearly going to have a crash, you know, something happens like that, you know. And inevitably, my first reaction, because of my upbringing, you know, is, Jesus Christ, I mean, Hare Krishna. So my first language that comes out is not the language of Krishna consciousness, it's the language of my Christian upbringing, like that. So that's what we've got to try, and all of you Christians out there, I mean, all of you Vaishnavas, you don't have to worry, but that's the language that we actually have to try and change, like that, through practice, on a daily basis, you know, chanting our 16 rounds, engaging in devotional service, associating with devotees, to try to change that conditioning we have, and make all the preparations that we possibly can to be in the best position possible for when we're actually leaving this body. And now I'm going to relay one final thing, actually. Because sometimes we think it's difficult. We think, gosh, but it's so difficult, you know. Spiritual life and the temptations of material life are so strong, you know. Well, to speak, devotees in general, a lot of devotees, they can maybe manage the growth temptations, but the subtle ones, they're more difficult, etc. And surrendering our false ego, as it says in the purport, understanding that we're not the proprietor of this body, you know, understanding that every time we express an opinion or every time that we get a little angry and all of those kind of things, that really 99% of the time it's a manifestation of our false ego, actually, that, you know, we get angry. Who are we to get angry? I mean, I get angry all the time, you know, but who am I to get angry? You know, it's essentially just a manifestation of, our false ego. So sometimes we think it's really, really difficult. I read recently, a devotee sent me on an email. He sent me an email about a personality called, I apologize to the devotees who were in Radhadesh when I gave class, because I mentioned this in there also. He mentioned, in this email, was talking about a personality called William Cowherd. What a nice name, huh? William Cowherd. I mean, we understand from a philosophical point of view, nothing happens by chance. Nothing happens by chance. We may think there are unintended consequences, but actually there's no such thing as an unintended consequence. Krishna's in control, and nothing happens by chance. So this gentleman's name was William Cowherd. And he was born, I think, I could be wrong with the specific details, all of you who are online right now, there's a new phenomena when you're giving class, you know. People have mobile devices with them, you know, and they start Googling to see if what you're saying is actually true. You can't tell lies anymore in Bhagavatam class. How tragic is that? You have to tell the truth. Oh, dear. Anyways, so William Cowherd. And William Cowherd, I think he was born in 1843. No going on Google, please. But I think it was around 1843 he was born. And he was a religious man. He was British. He was born in a place called Salford, or at least that's where he had his church, in a place called Salford, which is close to Manchester. And so he had his church. He was born in 1843, around about, probably started his church around 2530. So we're talking about the 1860s, 1870s, that kind of time. He started his church. And the main condition, if not the only condition, for joining not just his church, but being for a member of his congregation, given his name, William Cowherd, the one condition was you had to be a vegetarian. This is 1970. This is 150 years ago in the Malecha West. This is before George Bernard Shaw even, who was an avid vegetarian in the 1920s. You know, this is before, of course, Prabhupada came and the explosion of alternative living took place in the 1960s. This is 1870 in, you know, Salford, England. Which I don't know, even if you go to Salford, England today, it's a, like a rough, hard kind of like, you know, they're like salt of the earth people. Vegetarian? What are you really? You know, it's like even today it's difficult being a vegetarian in Salford. 1870, 150 years ago, and every one of his congregation had to be a vegetarian. When any of his congregation died, all of the local newspapers and all of the local weekly Christian, from the other Christian churches, their pamphlets and their newsletters, and the sermons in the other Christian churches around Salford would say, ah, look, another one of those fellas dead because they're vegetarians, you know. So every death in his congregation was blamed on being a vegetarian, you know. Whereas the deaths in their congregation, you know, they weren't blamed on anything. You know, so this guy had a, but he was rigid on this principle. Nobody could be a member of his congregation without being a vegetarian. And actually, when he left his body, his immediate successor, whose name escapes me now, but you'll find it on Google, but his immediate successor, he was the one who started the Vegetarian Society in England in the late 1870s, something like that. And in 1890, because of William Cowherd's preaching and his followers' preaching, in 1890, there were more vegetarian cafes in England than there are today. So if we think that we have it hard, think of William Cowherd in the 1870s, when society was much more barbaric and much more, in England at least, maybe not here, but in England, and much more kind of hostile to these types of ways of life. Yet he's established that through sheer determination, etc. Okay, I finished, I think, at 10 minutes to 9. I think that's time enough to call the class over, because I think we have to start early with meetings. I see a few hands. This gentleman was first, and you'll probably ask me difficult questions, so I'm not going to ask you anything. Yes, sir.
In Bhagavad Gita, surrender to me. And I read recently somewhere that if you are not ready to surrender, forget about Krishna consciousness. Forget about bhakti, forget about Krishna consciousness, it is impossible.
I think Ramapad Maharaj mentioned yesterday in class, intention brings attention. You know, look at the life of Arjamil. He was actually a very pukka Brahmin. And he was following the four regulative principles, etc. And then he got married. God, you know, got married, you know, those women, you know. He got married to one of those women, you know. Could you imagine if we were all gay? If we were all gay, then, you know, there'd be no problems in life, you know, because there wouldn't be all these problems created by these women. But anyway, he got married. And when he got married, that, you know, started a downward spiral. And that downward spiral led him not just to be engaged in sinful life, but it's described that he was a cheater and he was a bully and he took advantage of people and he intimidated people and he, you know, gosh, it sounds like my temple president in the 80s. But he did all of those things like that. But still, simply because he was attached to his son who had the same name as one of the names of Krishna, he was saved. So, I don't know where you heard that statement, but hey, you know, very few of us are on the platform of complete surrender. Very, very few of us are on the platform of complete surrender. We don't give up. We just acknowledge that, and we simply have an intention. We desire to have the intention. If we don't have the intention, we desire to develop the intention. And then mercy will come. Krishna's in the purport today. No matter how bad we get, no matter how fallen we become, no matter where we go, Krishna accompanies us everywhere. So therefore, there's always, always, always hope. Marge, you wanted to comment on that?
Yes, there are different accounts in the Bhagavatam, like Prahlad, like Ajamil, like Dhruva Maharaj, and a number of others, which are drawing out very important points about how wonderful Krishna consciousness is, and being a devotee or just trying, and how wonderful Krishna is. And in this case, this story is here in the Bhagavatam to show that even if, you know, what to speak of not quite being on the level of full devotional service, but even if you're sort of way out, but somehow, even for some sort of obscure indirect reason, you chant the holy names, even though, you know, it's not your idea to chant, not that you want to chant the holy names as such, but somehow if you do, but still the process and Krishna is so wonderful that you can go back to Godhead. In fact, you probably will go back to Godhead. Vishnav Chakravarti Thakur gives the example of a mango tree. Prabhupada describes it at the end of this chapter, that you, as soon as you got the seed basically planted, you've got the tree. It's not a matter of if the result will come, it's just a question of when. Hare Krishna.
Thank you very much, Maharaj. Nishingananda Prabhu, and then Jagjivan Prabhu, and then we'll finish because of...
Thank you for a wonderful lecture from about the heart and from your heart. Thank you so much. I have a comment and then I have a question. You did mention that much difficulty came from the West the further you went.
And he lives in Los Angeles, by the way.
And since I live in Los Angeles...
He actually lives west of Los Angeles. You cannot get further west. If you go further west, you become east again. Okay. Just to reestablish that for the devotees.
You know, when Prabhupada left to go to the west...
The west.
He had a choice of any country in the world, including Ireland. But he decided not to go to Dublin. He decided.
But we now have three Govinda's restaurants and a preaching center in Dublin, even though Srila Prabhupada never set his lotus feet on the soil of Ireland.
You know why I like to ask questions when Pragosh Prabhu is sitting on the Vyasasan? Because it's practically the only time I can get a word in edgewise. So, yeah, when you think of what occurred, the incorporation of ISKCON, the beginning of book distribution, of mass book distribution, the Bhaktivedanta Book Trust being set up in Los Angeles, Prabhupada calling L.A. his world headquarters, so many different things happened before Krishna consciousness really began to spread east again. I said book distribution. So, yes, there are, in any endeavor, some faults. There are a few black blemishes on the history of ISKCON that happened
few.
In the West. But the further west Prabhupada went, the more he established his mission. And that was fructified in his actually making California, Los Angeles, his world headquarters. So we have that mercy. Then, I'd like to ask you a question, which came up, which I think you can shed light on. And I've never thought of this question before, so this is not premeditated. We're not trying to blindside you in any way.
Oh, here we go. What time is it? 9 o'clock. What time is class finished? 9 o'clock, right?
But consistently throughout this chapter about Ajamil, his wife is referred to as a prostitute. Now, even in contemporary judicial systems, a person is given a sentence, he serves a sentence, and after that, he's considered, hopefully, remediated from his sinful life. Yet, we see constantly, there's never, you know, honey, or my dear, or my wife, or Mataji, it's always the prostitute. But she's married. She got married to him. So I don't get it. Why is she going to be held hostage to her sinful past when she, in fact, has legitimized her life and had children in serving her husband in a marriage? Can you please answer that question?
No. I was going to say that I actually, you know, don't really know enough about Ajamil's wife and why that. I mean, the question you asked is a good question, but it strikes me also. It seems unwarranted or strong. But Bhakti Chaitanya Maharaj looks like he wants to shed some light on that.
She continued to be a prostitute. I think what they call now the pimp, is that right?
Uh-huh.
He was the manager.
Uh-huh.
And they had, you know, a child.
Simple answer.
I didn't know that.
Thank you, Marsh.
Thank you, Marsh.
I didn't know that. Where is that? Is that? That's not in Bhagavatam, is it? No. Okay.
Where is it?
Okay.
It's somewhere else. I forget exactly.
So he was literally...
Okay, all those who are online, look that up on Google. Google that immediately.
He literally was selling her to other men. Okay, just in case anyone's not familiar with the term prostitute. So, Bhakti Siddhanta Maharaj said that Ajamil, even though he was married to his wife, he was, for money, he was selling her so other men could engage in illicit activity. Jagdeep Ampu.
Here it says Dasi Patim. She was a Dasi.
Yeah.
So that's, Prabhupada explained this in the chapter, what that means. You know, so just to clarify that. I have a comment. Maharaj answered the other question I had, so you're free of the question. The comment concerns your quote about mortality. And we were walking with Srila Prabhupada in Caracas, Venezuela, and Virabahu mentioned this point, that they say that we believe in God because of death.
Yes.
They said.
Oh, yes, I know that. Go ahead.
So Prabhupada said, so stop this, and we won't believe in Krishna. Stop death. Okay, let's make a deal. You stop death, and then we won't believe in Krishna. Of course, they can't do that, but that was his challenge to them, answering that question there. Okay.
I was just going to say, on a similar point, I was giving a public talk a little while ago, and, you know, just talking general philosophy like this. And a person in the audience said, but why do you make such a big deal of death? Everybody dies. I said, that's why we make such a big deal of it. I said, if I knew I wasn't going to die, I said, believe me, I wouldn't be sitting here making a big deal of death. It's this illusion they're in that because, you know, everybody dies somewhere or other, it's okay.
So another point which wasn't going to be a question, but Maharaj sort of answered it, concerning how Ajamil is meditating. In two verses prior to this, the term is akuta indriya. He's in full anxiety, and this is how he's chanting, in full, complete anxiety. And that intensity propels him to some purity in chanting, evidently. And it was an interesting further comment on...
So in other words, we talk about, you know, Sudanam and chanting Krishna's name in purity, and going back to your question, sir, actually, that, you know, the main thing is we chant. And if you're in fear, and if you're in anxiety, you will chant with intensity. You will chant with intensity. And that's actually a glorious thing. You know, it's a glorious thing to do because you will hold on to the name because you feel it's the thing that's going to give you protection and it's going to save you.
There's another point that the name is a person. That's not, we haven't dealt with that, but the name is actually a person. It's being called, and he's invoked at that point. And even in great anxiety intensity, he was invoked because of his independent mercy and his desire to be present. He was invoked.
Well, that's explained, that because you're calling a person, it's a name, but you're calling a person, then his people come. They come and bring you to that person. That's the whole process. Srila Prabhupada ki, Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Gaur Premanandi, Hare Krishna.